breaking up. Too much worth, sacrifice, and commitment had gone into it. I'd worked too hard to get Kiss where it was to throw it away. As far as I was concerned, everybody and anybody could leave. I was staying. I never pondered even taking a break. When a band takes a break, there's always a risk of never being able to get going again. I'd rather keep moving, even if the pace was slower or I took a few wrong turns. We risked losing all our momentum if we stopped. I also had seen enough people who had left bands or dissolved them, thinking they could continue on their own. That's a tough awakening. For me to suddenly take off the makeup and go solo back then? I could have done it, I guess, but I don't know what the outcome would have been. Kiss was an anomaly, so I don't know if the rules that apply to other bands also apply to us. Then there was the name, Kiss. Talk about brand recognition. Companies spend decades and millions of dollars to build that kind of respect and awareness. Other companies buy names that have been established. We established Kiss as a band, but it became as recognizable as a brand. And to give that up would have been stupid. Even if I couldn't match the success we'd already had, it was a huge advantage to have that name. But mostly, I liked the support of a band. I liked the security. I liked having other people to lean on rather than going it alone. That's why I got together with Gene in the first place. Because I didn't feel I could do what I wanted to do on my own. I'd always wanted a band. I wanted team members, and that was as true 10 years later as it was when I started out. Often the best way to achieve goals is to assemble a great team. Sometimes we just don't have that luxury. By the 1980s, the team around me was a frequently shifting cast of characters, and Gene was mostly absent. But there was one constant. Me. That was okay, because it meant I was steering the ship. There's a sense of security in having faith in the captain, and I had faith and always have had faith in myself. As people came and went during those years, as other members' commitment waxed and waned, it boiled down to this. How do I maximize what I have? And how do I make the most of the people who are here? Certain things I could control and others I couldn't. Certainly, with the non-makeup period, that balance shifted. I couldn't make guitar players do what I necessarily wanted them to do, so they either were asked to leave or they quit. I couldn't stop Gene from wanting to build a movie career, so I took up the slack. Ultimately, I learned not to depend on anyone else, and that has not changed since then, despite the later periods of stability within the band. It's safer, and it's more effective. It's always risky to empower somebody else. We have to have trust in somebody, and that trust has to come through experience. It's not about gut feeling. I don't give that trust to anyone except over time, after I see how they deal with issues, how consistent they are, how they deal with crises. As far as dealing with the band in the 1980s, I basically took sole leadership of it. I made the most of what I had, and I didn't dwell on what I didn't have. I wanted to do what I was capable of doing, rather than getting hung up and thinking about things beyond my control. When I look back at those years, I see it was a pivotal time for the band, but there have been many, and it's always been about problem solving. It's all about maintaining the freedom to keep pursuing our dreams, in whatever form those dreams have taken at a given point in the trajectory of our lives. The band will always be my baby. And for many people, as well as for me, for much of the history of the band, that means not giving it up. Of course, my view on that, too, has evolved over time. Not necessarily the baby part, but my willingness to give up my role in it. I sent out a tweet last year with a picture of the Eagles in their current incarnation, without co-founder Glenn Frey. I wrote, "The Eagles tour has already added more shows due to demand. Seeing a photo of the band now with one original member is a testament to the timeless power and endurance of great songs created over decades by musicians united in pursuing a musical vision and standard." Then I started getting all these bitter responses along the lines of, "They're not the Eagles. These guys should hang it up. They're a cover band." I was reading all this stuff, and then came another line of thinking. "Oh, Paul, you're saying that because of Kiss. You're a cover band, too." I rarely respond to stuff like that, but this time I did. I wrote, "To the whiners, the hundreds of thousands who will love seeing the Eagles on this tour don't care about you, and will have a great time while you whine about which and what band isn't meeting your criteria. In a world where someone else is happy, your unhappiness doesn't matter. And if you don't think I'm laying the groundwork for leaving the band, I have a bridge to sell you. I love the idea that the Eagles now is being led by a son of one of the founders, Deacon Frey, a founder, Don Henley, and a bunch of other guys. Or take the band, Yes. There's not an original member in Yes. Yet do I consider them a cover band? No. Because a band that exists over decades evolves through personnel changes and health crises. So do I consider this to be Yes? Absolutely. It didn't change overnight. Members have come and gone. The Eagles are the same way. Timothy Schmidt is great, but he certainly wasn't in the original band. Nor was Joe Walsh. And Deacon Frey was baby batter. Do I like the idea that the endurance of a band isn't limited to a particular set of members? You bet. It's all about seeing your role. And I know mine. To give people the support and license to serve as their own advocate. Self-empowerment is the key to everything that I won by fighting against those who told me how things had to be or what they expected. Understandably, someone may want you to fight. All I want to do is take that off someone's shoulders. You choose your fight. We all choose our fight. When we're at the biggest moment of our life, at its end, we need to make that decision with a clear conscience, knowing the decision is ours and ours alone. It puts so much in perspective for me. I've seen people leave this earth who wanted to connect with somebody they clearly did not regard as a stranger. My life is on my terms. At times when Kiss looked like it was going to implode, and critics or the people who didn't like us were salivating, I would revive and resuscitate it in its death throes, if for no other reason than the fact that nobody is going to tell me when it's over. That's not acceptable. I believe the band must continue, even if someone else might say the opposite. I certainly know people who have said, "My band had to end because I'm not going to be in it anymore." Well, I disagree. Our band should continue because what we've created and what I've worked so hard for is still valid. And as corny as it might seem, Kiss may function as a beacon of light for some people. It's so much more than the best goddamn show out there. It's the rising up of the underdog to win. Success has never taken that away from us. For that reason alone, I'd like to think it should endure. If all it means is, if I can do it, you can do it, that is a message that will never grow old. I want to champion every person out there facing adversity. The power and meaning of Kiss can also transcend the individuals in it. Some friends and people I'm close to have said to me that I must continue. They make it very clear that they don't want to lose their emotional connection to the band, its stabilizing effect on their lives. And I say, I understand, but I did this in the first place to write my own rules. And that includes being able to say when it ends for me. It's interesting, though, because the other side of the coin is people saying that some star athlete or other should hang it up because they're not as good as they were in their heyday. To that, I say, it's your right to stop seeing them, but they owe you nothing. They've given you everything. Nobody has to apologize for doing what they love. They get to decide if and when it's over for them. And if it's over for you, you have the right to stop going to the games or listening to the music, whatever it is. You have the right to stop buying tickets. It's an odd idea that the people who have made you happy now need to go away because they're not living up to your expectations. This has never been about anybody else's expectations, but mine. Chapter 14. When you find the true meaning in what you've accomplished, you'll fall in love all over again. I would say without hesitation that the most fucked up people are entertainers. They crave attention. They crave approval and validation of their worth that they don't inherently feel, and they don't look to fill that void just through relationships. They seek it from a crowd. For most people, the larger a crowd, the more intimidated they feel. For plenty of folks, being forced to stand in front of 20,000 people would be their worst nightmare. But I happen to know a lot of people who consider that their Disneyland, because the people who are most insecure, if they have the wherewithal and the tools, use that platform to put themselves in front of mass adulation. It's so apparent to me. Why do bands want to be on tour all the time? Because that's where they feel most omnipotent. That's where they feel most important. Do they feel important when they go to the grocery store? I guess not. Do they feel important when they take their kids to school? Apparently the answer is no. The people who seek attention are the ones who are the most, I don't want to say maladjusted, but they have issues with self-confidence and self-worth, and they look for validation externally that they didn't get either from the people around them or internally. When Kiss started out, people like Bill Acoin, our manager, and Sean Delaney, a jack of all trades who did everything from helping refine our stage moves and collaborating on songs to driving our van in the early days, had an amazing ability to make each person in the band feel he was the favorite. Which is terrific because the bickering and the attention and the approval that four very needy babies needed would not allow anyone to be an actual favorite. Both Bill and Sean could make each band member feel that he was the best and most important, like he was the driving force or the most talented or the special one. If not for them, I don't think Kiss would have survived. Bill, in particular, was excellent at playing parent to a bunch of guys who weren't much younger than him. In earlier times, performing was my oxygen. It was my blood. Today, I love performing for different reasons. I still covet and cherish the attention and validation, but I don't depend on it anymore. I love it because I don't need it. Somebody asked me recently, "Why do you still do it?" "You know," I said, "being away from home is horrible. Going to sleep by myself in a hotel is horrible. But having that curtain go up and knowing that people have been waiting for the legend of Kiss and what we embody to be with them for a night is so exhilarating. That's why I do it. I do it because there's nothing to compare to being Kiss, and I love it. I love what we are. I love what we create, and most of all, I love the connection to the audience. When I started, I did it for myself. Now, I do it for them, and it's made all the difference. Early on, I didn't ever want to go home. Whereas now, I tolerate everything that goes along with being on tour and being away from Aaron and our kids. Because being on stage is part of who I am, and my family has to understand it's a part of me. I don't have to do it, but I want to. Maybe as the puzzle's gotten larger, the piece that Kiss represents has gotten smaller. But it's still an essential piece of the puzzle. Nothing can measure up to being Kiss on stage. Nothing can measure up to that outfit and being up there singing those songs or being there for the audience. At this point, there really is a legend of Kiss, and I'm grateful to be part of it. I always say, show me a band that tells you they want to play clubs, and I'll show you a band that can't play an arena. They're both fun, but nobody's going to tell me they'd rather play multiple clubs or multiple auditoriums than play a stadium, an arena, or an outdoor festival ground. The energy is that much larger. I guess when people talk about electricity in the air, it has some real basis in physiology because the energy that comes from an audience of 100,000 people can almost knock you off your feet. It's like a tidal wave. And to know that it's all there for you is incredibly empowering and exhilarating. When the original four members of KISS reunited, there was, in my mind, a great sense of perhaps being able to fix things and come back smarter, with all of us appreciating who we are and where we'd been and picking up the flag and running. KISS without makeup was still making very, very good money, but nothing could compare to what we had done in our heyday. When we put the makeup back on, I found that I was yearning for that level of success again. Not beforehand, oddly enough, but once I committed to doing it, I thought, I'm going to savor this a lot differently than I did the first time. I was determined to appreciate it as an adult and take it in on all levels, which I hadn't done the first time around. That was palpable and emotional. Many nights I choked up on stage. Being able to revisit something with a deeper appreciation of it was a gift. Who gets the chance to do that? The first time I hadn't lived enough or gone through enough to really see the success as part of a bigger picture. And then to see it again, with a more mature eye, was wondrous. Now, we've sustained it for decades again. I still remember being backstage at the American Music Awards with Tupac, when we were unannounced surprise guests, appearing with makeup for the first time in well over a decade. And I was back there thinking, is the audience going to laugh at us? Are they going to boo? Are they going to see it as a joke? Then we walked out, and every adult musician in the audience was reduced to being a kid again. The wonder on their faces was unbelievable. I mean, I can remember looking at some very famous faces that all of a sudden were transported. That was an incredible feeling, that we actually could go back, put on those outfits, put on the boots, put on the makeup, and be KISS. I didn't realize the magnitude, the importance to people, the impact we had had on people. That first blush of returning and getting up early in the morning in Los Angeles to listen on the phone as Ticketmaster put tickets on sale and we sold out a show in a few minutes and rolled into a second show and a third show, that was a gift, and it was a gift to all of us. When we sold out Tiger Stadium to kick off the tour, I was stunned. I hadn't realized how much we meant to people and how much they wanted us back. I guess no one really talked about it because maybe no one thought it was possible. And when it happened, it really was the second coming. I only wish that everybody had realized that it could have been a new beginning, but that would have meant work. I was prepared to appreciate it and savor it, and feel blessed. And feeling that way obligates me to do something as well as I can, to be worthy of it. Over time, unfortunately, not everyone saw it that way. Once we weren't firing on all cylinders, then we were KISS in name only. We weren't living up to our obligations to our fans and to ourselves. That was disappointing. And demoralizing to a point where we really felt we needed to pull the plug. But I love this band so much that it quickly became clear to me that I didn't want it to end. I just wanted the pain and the embarrassment to end. It's been nice to reconnect with Ace in recent years, to sing on his album and have him on a KISS cruise. It was terrific, but it doesn't mean any more than what it was. It wasn't a mating dance or anything. It was about enjoying the good part of our shared history, and maybe my being able to help him out. It was not going to lead anywhere except to our having a good time and my embracing somebody who has been very important in my life. Without Ace, there wouldn't have been a KISS. So isn't that worth celebrating and embracing? Around the time of our induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, a reporter asked me,
"For old time's sake, one more time, you wouldn't want to do that? Perform together again?"
I said, "How many times have you been married?"
"Twice," the reporter said.
"How about for old time's sake you go back and spend the night with your ex-wife?" I think we came to an understanding at that moment. To have Ace back in a larger capacity in my life is nice. The idea of having him on a Kiss cruise 10 years ago would have been preposterous. There had been too many acrimonious feelings and unresolved issues, and just a lack of comfort. But life's too short. If Ace were a dick now, I wouldn't want him around. But if we can enjoy each other, we have too much shared magic not to. Peter, unfortunately, is a different story. I don't think Peter has any life. He seems consumed by some kind of reality that his wife tells him. He's always been negative and always maintained an us-against-them mentality. I don't want that in my life. It's not about having differences, because I'm sure Ace and I have differences. It's Peter's overall sense of anger and resentment and feeling like a victim. He needs to acknowledge his participation and then change things. I think Peter's life is probably very one-dimensional, uninteresting, unstimulating, which is a result of seeing the world negatively and seeing everyone, from the band members to the hotel service people, as disrespectful. That's not a world anyone should live in, and I don't want to be a part of it. In the past few years, I began to realize that life is like dodgeball. In one form or another, we're just trying to make sure the ball doesn't hit us. And in the course of that, we watch people around us get knocked out. In our own way, we're all trying to duck the ball. Sometimes the total picture of somebody is frozen in time when they die. They become talented and beautiful forever. Look at the difference between the living James Dean and Marlon Brando and the James Dean and Marlon Brando we think of now that they're gone. Kurt Cobain was clearly tortured from within by mental illness and the manifestations of drug addiction. But who's to say that 2 albums later he wouldn't have been panned by every critic, and the people who loved him would have scratched their heads at the music he was making? Youth walks the high wire, and the lucky ones make it across. Some are predisposed to more risks, but I don't know that Kurt Cobain was anywhere near a point of being able to embrace himself, to love himself. Fortunately, I'm more than content. I'm thrilled with life. My life has exceeded anything I ever could have hoped for. Only when we live and set goals and learn things along the way do we have any idea of what is possible. We have to experience life to know its potential. What we exude and what others see is usually a product of what's inside us. I'm not the person I was 5 years ago, and certainly I'm not the person I was 30 years ago. I'm happier, more content, more likable. It's hard to be likable when we're unhappy. Someone may take pity on us and, for their own reason, want to befriend us because it makes them feel better about themselves. I call that the Florence Nightingale syndrome. Some people like to find a person who's in worse shape than they are because it makes them feel better about themselves. It's comforting, in an odd way, I guess. Yet when someone is happy, people just want to be around that person, and perhaps want to know why they're happy. Chapter 15. Vanity isn't narcissism. The better physical shape we're in, the better prepared we are to take on other aspects of our lives. When I'm in shape, I have better relationships. When I have better relationships, I eat better. These are all mini mountains we can scale, and success at one motivates us to tackle the next. Nobody wants to see a fat guy in tights. That fact first occurred to me shortly after I turned 30. I still looked fit because of all the shows we played, which were physically and aerobically demanding. But cholesterol runs high in my family. I look at a steak and my cholesterol goes up. Growing up, the basic food groups were meat, cheese, whole milk, and eggs. Both my mom and dad had coronary bypasses, and my grandmother died of heart disease back when it was routinely a death sentence. So I realized I would probably have to work at staying in shape going forward. In the early 1980s, TV fitness gurus were all the rage. So, grasping at straws, I got a number for a guy who had a show called Body by Jake. It was the era of Arnold Schwarzenegger's ascent in Hollywood, and Jake was built like a brick shithouse. I didn't want to look like that, but I called him to see about training. At some point during the conversation, he said, "I'm gonna make you hurt." And I thought, why would I pay somebody to make me hurt? Even then I knew that we don't measure how fit we are by how much we hurt. I can't walk, so boy, I must be doing great. He wasn't the guy for me. Fortunately, a friend of mine then referred me to another trainer named Michael Romanelli. He asked me what kind of shape I was in. I kind of scoffed and told him I was in better shape than 98% of the population. Once I truly started to get in shape, I realized that if I was in better shape than 98% of the population, the rest of the population was teetering on the edge of death. The good thing, though, is that Michael showed me there was really no secret to getting in shape. There was no need for a gym, no need for expensive equipment. Up to then, I had the common misperception that we need to rely on externals and intimidation by people who supposedly knew more than we do and who get us to buy things or subscribe to things or sign up for things we really don't need. Bricklayers don't spend time in the gym. They lift bricks. Lifting your own weight is effective. Crunches don't take anything. So this can be broken down into something that's doable for everybody. With that in mind, I got in great shape. That was 30 years ago. I'm in uncharted territory at this point. If you'd have told me back then that I'd still be running around in a spandex jumpsuit today, I would have asked you what you were smoking. I won't tell you I'm the same person now that I was then. Nobody is immune to aging. Can I do as much on stage now as I once did? I would have to say no. But I do a lot. And I do far more than people in most other bands, even bands whose members are 25 years old, not 65. To be in shape now validates my life and the quality of my life. To be on stage and feel relatively ageless is exhilarating. So these days, more than ever, I feel an intense desire to exercise. In fact, if I don't, it bothers me. Because when I do, I know that I've done my part. Once you get started, the rewards of taking care of yourself continue to motivate you. When I first started working out, I didn't realize how out of shape I was until a few days into a workout when my body was really in shock. But that passes. And there's nothing more motivating than results. After 4 weeks of working out, I looked in the mirror and got it. I understood what it was all about. When you start working out, it's easy to wonder why you're doing it. There's the soreness and the inconvenience and the time it takes away from your day. But once you see results, whether that means losing pounds or inches or just feeling better, you want to do it more. I remember about a month in, I started to see and feel a difference. And I just wanted to keep going. It became something I put on my calendar and was non-negotiable. It became time I wouldn't let be taken away from meetings or social events. It was my time, and it no longer seemed like a chore. It was more like an adventure. In addition, endorphins are one of the strongest drugs in the world. When our endorphins are flowing, our minds are clearer. When our bodies feel fit and our minds are clear, we feel ready to take on the world. I've had times when I felt I could lift a building. Luckily, I wasn't stupid enough to hurt my back and try, but there is a sense of being capable of anything. Working out has become a priority in my life, knowing that anything I do to make myself better will ultimately help me in everything else I do. It became part of my commitment to bettering myself, One effective way to feel good about ourselves is to be in shape. It not only changes the chemistry of our bodies, it also changes how we view our bodies and ourselves more generally. It's all-encompassing. For me, it's also necessary. It requires a discipline to maintain who I am on stage, though, quite honestly, I'm vain enough to want to do it for myself, quite apart from how it helps me perform. A good friend of mine once wrote in a book that I was terribly vain. I thought, how can I be terribly vain? You're either vain or you're not. And I'm vain. So I said to him, I'm not terribly vain. I'm vain. You're dead or you're not dead. Being vain is different from being narcissistic. The whole basis of narcissism is the story of Narcissus wasting away or drowning by becoming obsessed with his own reflection. Well, that's a serious negative. But nobody should confuse narcissism with vanity. I'm proud to be vain. Who doesn't want to look their best? Meanwhile, I don't want to waste away or drown. As I learned how to stay in shape, I also realized there is more to it than just eating well and exercising. If all we gain is muscle mass, we gain nothing. If we are not working our minds and our hearts, we wind up being a car without an engine. It's great to start off a day reflecting on what we have done and what we want to accomplish or how we want to take on the world. And when we go to sleep, when we are lying in bed, we should be in a position to be grateful for the day gone by and to thank ourselves or whatever higher power we believe in for a valuable day of experience and another day spent getting closer to our goals. I don't want to sound like Yoda, but our body and mind need to work in harmony. If we want to experience a life of the highest quality, making the most of all its possibilities, we need to take care of not only our bodies, but our minds, our souls. Ultimately, nothing will make us feel better about the world than helping it. Nothing will make us feel better about people than helping them. Generosity of spirit is necessary to live a positive life. I wake up every day and have a thought for what I want to get out of the day. At the end of the day, I know I accomplished that goal or worked toward it. Without that, life is empty, no matter what shape we're in. Process leads to the completion of goals in life. It's all about process. We can't get from point A to point B without taking the first step. So the process, boring as it may seem, is actually exhilarating. I'm far from obsessed with working out, but it's necessary to elevate my quality of life. Committing to staying in shape also reinforces my ability to do something that I'm not always all that enthused about doing. But I know the process will lead to looking better, feeling better on stage, and standing taller. Of course, we should never do anything until we're ready to do it 100%. There have been times when I didn't want to work out for a year. I wouldn't do that now, but I don't believe in doing things half-assed. If you're not going to commit yourself to something, then don't do it at all. When you're ready, jump in. I'm not saying we have to devote all our energy to one thing, but we have to give 100% to whatever we're doing at any moment. Otherwise, what's the point? If we read a book and we don't really focus on it, we have to read it again. One of the motivating factors for this book came from the fact that I wish somewhere along the line somebody in my life had been more of a peer than a steroided-up muscle freak guiding me to good health. Honestly, even when I had trainers, it became apparent to me how a trainer looks is a very clear reflection of how that trainer thinks you should look. That's key. If a trainer looks like he shits muscles, unless that's what you want to look like, you're with the wrong person. My tendency is to get thick and bulky, so it's important for me to be careful not to lift heavy weights. And it was hard to explain that to a trainer. A few trainers would say, yeah, I understand. Then all of a sudden I'm looking in the mirror and seeing Lou Ferrigno. At one point, Bill O'Coin said to me, you're not supposed to look like that. which is to say, my body had started to look like I was going to shave my chest and douse myself with baby oil. So it's a matter of knowing from experience, and then putting your foot down and saying, this is what I'll do, and this is what I won't do. If you want a trainer, find one who looks like how you want to look, because that's how a trainer is going to try to make you look. Body image is like anything else. It's personal. There's no right or wrong in terms of what you think looks good. I just happen to want my arms to touch my sides. These days, the heaviest weight I lift ever is 10 pounds. As a rule, it's more like 2 or 3 pounds. And yet I've got the body I want because of the repetitions. Unless you want to become Mr. America or star as Hercules, you want to work your muscles with repetitions, not heavy weights. A lot of people make the same mistake I did, pushing themselves to see how heavy a dumbbell they can lift. Sometimes the dumbbell is the person trying to lift the dumbbell. It's just that to most people, and to me in the beginning, the concept of high reps and low weights seems at odds with the idea of building muscle. But what we actually want to achieve is muscle fatigue. And muscle fatigue can come from either lifting a heavy weight a few times or lifting a light weight many times. I had to come to that realization. Male bodybuilders tend to look like freaks in a suit because their lats are too big. They look like you put clothes on a gorilla. I remember my trainer, who had been a competitive bodybuilder, said, "The guy who wins a bodybuilding contest is the least healthy guy." The coming onto the scene of steroids and human growth hormones turned something that, in theory, was valid into something grotesque. Bodybuilding was initially a healthy approach to working out. Now, unfortunately, it's just a freak show. And it's not because of the workouts, it's because of how they're enhancing the workouts. When guys like that put on a suit, they look, I feel bad saying this, like they're trying to take a shit. Their necks look like they're about to explode. I have always thought, I don't want to look like that. Forget about competing in the Speedo. We have to wear clothes. And those body types don't look very good in clothes. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. This is just my take. But with few exceptions, when most people see us for the first time, we're clothed. So how our clothes fit and how they drape is a concern, even a priority. How do we look in clothes? Getting out of them is a bonus, but we don't get a chance to get out of them with somebody unless, first, we're accepted when we're in them. It's not what we accomplish lifting. It's how we lift and how we put the weight down. It's the control of the motion. That's how to get in shape. We get more out of the muscles when we use them from the beginning of a movement to the end. Lifting a weight is half of it. Bringing it down is the other half. And I'd rather do 50 curls with a 5-pound weight than do 5 with a 50-pound weight. I've been doing the same workout for 10-plus years, and I have to say that when I found what I'm doing now, this cardio bar workout, I knew I'd found an all-encompassing workout. I don't even have to alter it when I'm preparing for a tour. I try to do it 3 or 4 times a week, not because I have to, but because it feels great. It involves doing crunches, lifting light weights, doing extensions with my legs, twisting. Like anything else, when you find something you love, in my case an exercise regimen that I enjoy, it's more gratifying than debilitating. There may be some hills and there may be some valleys, but once someone has the right plan, it goes back to what I say over and over. We'll be able to determine how important something is to us by how hard we're willing to work to achieve it. It's about determination. Once we're ready to do it, it's pretty easy. And fortunately, it's never too late to get in shape. It's all relative. When somebody says that you look great for 50, it doesn't mean you look great for 30. And why should it? Looking great for 50 is enough in itself. Being in shape has made all the difference for me, no matter how old I am. Nobody can kid you and tell you that they're the same person they used to be. I'm not. But a seasoned fighter throws fewer punches while making each punch count. I make sure everything I do has impact. I've become a wiser fighter. We all have to let go of any preconceived ideas we have about what getting older means, because that's usually based on a child's perception. It's not based on reality. It's based on what we supposed our parents were like at a given age. We somehow believed that our parents had all the answers. Then once we become parents, we realize that we're still kids, trying to figure it all out. At this point, being in shape validates my life and the quality of my life. It's interesting to have young fans come to KISS shows and be blown away by how I look physically. And I've definitely seen wives elbow their husbands while mouthing, "He's older than you are." But there's no secret to it. And it's not an obsession or a chore. I can remember a time when I thought that people who worked out a lot had some kind of compulsion or almost a weakness that made them do it. But done the right way, it's neither of those things. I didn't get to where I am overnight, but I'm here to tell you, once that engine is turned on and those pistons are chugging, there's no telling how long you can keep it on the road. As you know, I've got 3 kids younger than age 15. I've met many of my friends through those kids, and that means a lot of them are 15 or 20 years younger than I am. Most can't keep up with me. We all play beat the clock and lose. Time always wins, but we can fight it in a way that's not embarrassing. We had to let go of preconceived notions about what it means to get older, and there's certainly no shame in trying to stay young. I, for one, don't mind getting older, but I don't want to get old. And so far, it's working. KISS is still touring, hitting dozens of countries on 5 continents in recent years. The annual KISS Cruise has so far attracted fans from 33 countries. The KISS Army, and now Navy, is alive and well. What started out as a protest in front of a radio station in Terre Haute, Indiana, by kids upset that the disc jockeys wouldn't play the KISS songs they wanted to hear, is now several generations deep. And all of this is possible because I can still perform at the physical level our shows demand. Part of what keeps KISS immortal is that, for all intents and purposes, we look the same. We maintain the illusion. I may not be ageless, but I am happy. Chapter 16. Pride in what we do is pride in who we are. I'm not a risk taker. I don't skydive. Why would I go up thousands of feet in the air and jump out when I'm already on the ground? That doesn't make sense to me. I've never thought I needed to risk my life to prove I'm alive. But I do like ice cream, despite my family's cholesterol problem. In the 1980s, as I entered my 30s, I went to a doctor to have my levels checked for the first time in my life, and he said, "You can never eat ice cream again." I said, "You're talking to the wrong guy." Life doesn't work that way. I don't want to eat a protein bar that tastes like silly putty and carpet shavings. Being healthy and eating fairly well doesn't have to mean compromising taste. Too many people see food as just fuel or an excuse to have an hour off from work. It's true that feeding ourselves is something we have to do several times a day, day in and day out. But it can be transformed into a positive aspect of our lives. Food can be a sensory treat. It has aesthetic beauty. You can experience a meal. You can enjoy a meal. In America, though, we tend to shove food into our mouths like garbage. It's regarded as fuel as opposed to something worth savoring. The thing is, it's something we have to do anyway, and elevating a daily necessity like that is edifying. By changing the experience, we change how we see ourselves. I say, cook like you give a damn. It's another way to take pride in doing something right. Anything worth doing is worth doing well. There's no point in attempting something without committing ourselves to it fully. Otherwise, we sabotage the potential for it to succeed, and we also sabotage the potential for it to give us all that it can. We can only get out of something as much as we put into it. That means children, that means relationships, that means exercise, and that means food. Everything.
Just a few days ago, I made pasta for myself.
It may seem like a weird statement and perhaps overblown for the situation, but I can't tell you how happy I was sitting down with that bowl of what's called cacio e pepe. It's spaghetti with ground black pepper, butter, and grated pecorino romano. I sat in my kitchen by myself, just so happy. It was a relatively simple meal, and yet there was satisfaction in having done it properly, and in knowing that I didn't take the path of least resistance. I could have just slapped together a sandwich. Instead, I provided an opportunity not only to feel good about myself, but also to eat the rewards. How cool is that? Blandness and mediocrity are easy. It doesn't always take a lot of effort to elevate our sense of self. That bowl of cacio e pepe wasn't a tremendous effort, and yet it was an effort. And that effort made me enjoy the meal and feel better about myself in a fundamental way. If I had chosen not to make the dish, I would have sat there afterward and thought, I should have, and I could have. It would have been a waste. A waste of calories, sure, but perhaps most importantly, a waste of an opportunity. It's crazy, but that simple bowl of pasta was my life in a meal. Doing that sort of thing gives us a sense of pride in ourselves. It's not necessarily something we have to share with others, although that's terrific too. It starts with us. The optimal way to enhance ourselves is not to look for approval or validation from the outside. It comes first from the inside. It's nice to have it reinforced, but it's hollow unless we believe it ourselves. It's no different with KISS. It's never been about someone else thinking we did a great show on any given night. It's never been about a great review for any given show. It's only about how I saw the show. The rest of it, and it may seem contradictory or hypocritical, is only of any value to me if it correlates with my own assessment. Otherwise, I discard it. If everybody around me says it was a great show and I didn't feel it, I'm left feeling hungry. I'm left feeling disappointed. It's much more fulfilling to base things on our own perceptions than somebody else's. That's the same reason I ask my children to try to examine how they feel when they succeed at something, rather than simply seeking parental approval. I once had a carpenter at my house working on a cabinet. I saw that he was doing really shoddy work, so I said to him, "Forget about what I think about it. How can you accept it? This is your work. This is your craft. Forget about me. What about you?" When we do something, are we doing it for someone else, or are we doing it for ourselves? If we get nothing back from someone else, what we get internally should make it worthwhile. The bonus is the external. The sense of self and knowing that we did a good job, knowing, for instance, that we're good parents or that we're good people, should start with knowing we're living up to our own potential. Obviously, the results will show in our children, in the path we choose, and the impact we have on the people around us, but we are defined by our successes as well as our attempts. Doing our best elevates our lives and the quality of our existence. Even when we're by ourselves, do we want to eat slop, or do we want to create something that's a reflection of caring?
If I make a great meal and no one else is there to share it with, the most important element of the satisfaction and validation has to come from me, not from those around me.
I came to cooking by necessity. When I started out, I didn't know the first thing about it. I just needed to make healthy food for my young son after his mother and I split up. I also wanted him to see that life goes on and that I would make sure everything was okay. Very quickly, I found myself reaching a point where I no longer wanted to make food that fulfilled the basic need for nourishment, but food that was pleasurable to eat and look at. And even though I didn't know how to do that, I had a pretty good idea how I might learn to. In 1977, I went to London and visited a clothing store called Ebony. It was on South Moulton Street, which was lined with cool shops. At the time, I was a horrible dresser. I wore clothes that looked as if I had borrowed them from Thomas Jefferson, and in terms of understanding how to dress, I was clueless. So I went into Ebony and picked up a sports jacket. I took it to one of the clerks and said, "I like this jacket. Can you pick a shirt that goes with it?" Then I asked him to pick out a pair of pants and a tie. I did the same thing another time, in another shop, and then I made myself a chart that had this shirt with that jacket and that tie. It seemed to make sense to me. I would write it down. I started to go shopping and look for things that were similar to, say, the shirt, and marked down on my chart that this new shirt could also go with that jacket and that tie. Then I started adding things. Let's see. This sports coat is similar to the one I have, so I could wear it with these pants and this shirt. After a while, I was able to jettison the chart, and to have confidence in my ability to choose. I created a style by starting with just two outfits and having a structure that allowed me to learn. I was methodical about it. The same is true for how I learned to write songs. Initially, I listened to songs I liked and tried to write one like it. "Oh, I like that song by The Who. I'm going to write one like it." That went on even later when, for instance, I wrote Hard Luck Woman after listening to Rod Stewart. I would hear something and absorb it and emulate it. Hotter Than Hell was my All Right Now by Free. The templates for my songwriting were the people I admired, the people who inspired me. Over time, if you're good, you can transform those inspirations into something new. It's a question of taking different ingredients and turning them into something that's familiar, but not a copy of any of them. If, as a singer, I could transform a love of Sam Cooke, Steve Marriott, and Robert Plant into a style of my own, why couldn't I do the same with food? And I did. Step by step. A process. I learned some basic building blocks and perfected a few dishes that allowed me to broaden my repertoire over time. But it all started with one dish and one step. One of the first things I started to get good at was making meatballs. Anybody can make a meatball. It's just a lump of meat, after all. All you have to do is take some ground meat and roll it into a ball. But then I began to wonder, how can I improve it? How do I elevate it? Then I remembered my mom's meatloaf. Most people grow up despising meatloaf. That's because it's often just a 5-pound hamburger. But my mom was smart enough to use a mix of different meats and different proportions of fat to meat to create a different flavor profile. When I first said to my kids I was going to make meatloaf, without even knowing what it would taste like, just from watching television, they thought I might as well be feeding them cockroaches. But as soon as they took a bite, it became one of their favorite things to eat. So, what's a meatball? A ball of meat. That's where it starts. But then you go from there. I wanted to learn how to improve it, create different textures and flavor profiles. Luckily, my friend and chef extraordinaire, Rocco DeSpirito, gave me his mama's recipe, which was a roadmap to perfection. Committing to doing something challenging is incredibly satisfying. If we treat what we do as a craft or an art form, it enhances the people around us. Even though I originally started cooking for a very simple, uncomplicated reason, to feed my son, Evan, it led to my seeing that cooking can be a means of exploration, and that exploration can be gratifying. The joy I get from Emily loving my pasta with peppers and onions, or Colin and Sarah's love of my frittata, elicits an almost childish pride in me. Oftentimes we can initially do something for one reason, and the reward we get is not the intended one, or it's more than the intended one. It fulfills the original need, but then opens other doors that we couldn't have gotten to otherwise. For example, had I not done The Phantom of the Opera, I wouldn't have written a book. Because not only did Phantom fulfill a decade-old yearning to do theater in general, and The Phantom of the Opera in particular, But also, when I did it, I suddenly realized why it was that important to me, which I had been clueless about. It was so obvious, once I started doing it, what the connection was. Phantom led to my working with children with facial differences and their parents. None of that would have been possible otherwise. I never would have revealed my microtia to anybody. I had to do Phantom first, and then those doors, which I never would have found otherwise, opened. When we commit to doing something, there's no way for us to know where it'll take us. Then we have to be receptive to possibilities and the doors that open. Most of the time, they're going to be doors that we couldn't even see beforehand. Food is not unlike art or music. We don't have to do it well to appreciate it. Because someone goes to a museum and looks at art doesn't mean that person can paint, but it shouldn't stop them from trying. The same is true with music. I remember listening to songs.